Rich Kimble, Carrie Haskell, and on the telephone line, it's our friend David Roth of Defector, co-host of the Distraction Podcast. Good afternoon, Mr. Roth.
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. How are you feeling?
I'm good. I'm at the stage, I guess, you know, no one that's listening is at any risk. Obviously, this isn't how radio works, but I do have COVID. It's the hot new thing, bringing it back very strongly. But I'm at the part of it now where I'm mostly just bored. I don't actually feel very sick anymore, so that's good. But I'm quarantining from my wife, who is continuing to test negative. So, like, we talk on the phone from inside our apartment. It feels like 2021 all over again, in a fun way.
We did that last summer. My wife got it, and then we put her in a room in the back of the house where she couldn't infect the rest of us. And then in December, I finally got it and did the same thing. We were really good at isolation because we didn't spread it. And yeah, a lot of text messaging, occasionally stomping on the floor, like, where's my food? I'm hungry.
Yep. Yeah, this is kind of what's embarrassing. I mean, we don't have that big an apartment we're in New York, but it's like big enough that there's still moments where she'll have to call me and be like, I'm yelling for you. Like, and she's like 20 feet away, you know, but I'm just back here in the germ chamber, minding my own business. I don't always hear everything. But yeah, you know, it's given me a great opportunity to catch up on posts. That's been cool. yeah, I'm anxious to get back out in the world and, you know, go get a sandwich or something.
All right. So kind of cruel to even ask this. What has been more painful, having COVID or watching the Mets?
Well, thankfully, I haven't been able to watch them since I've been in here. I could be streaming it, but I don't need to watch them get swept by the Kansas City Royals. So I followed the transactions, and you know, everybody at work was very nice about the fact that I was at the time too sick to write a blog about how upset I was. And now that they're going to play the rest of the year as like half of a 101-win team from last year and half of the Syracuse Mets, I can kind of just take the rest of the summer off. Like, if I want to watch, I can do it. But if I decide I want to adopt the Cincinnati Reds and become a Reds guy, I think nobody would really blame me for it at this point. I'm more or less fine with the moves they made. I just resent the fact that I'm going to have 2 months of really crappy baseball to watch.
Well, here in Red Sox Nation, Chaim Bloom decided, you know, the best thing to do, I mean, we could sell some guys who aren't back next year and try to strengthen our roster for a good run in 24, or maybe we could pick up some guys who could help us secure a wild card. But those are awfully confusing options, so let's just stay the course.
I'm going to say, what if there was a third way that involved you continuing to be disappointing in exactly the same way?
Yes, yes.
The thing with the Sox is that they're 7 games above 500, right? Or
yeah,
something like that.
I think so.
I mean, they're not actually bad.
No,
it's just
no.
One of those things where I read today, I guess Ken Rosenthal is doing a sort of a roundup about the moves that didn't happen. And he said that Bloom was apparently in on Verlander, that there was a Red Sox package that they were interested in trying to acquire him. Which I think would have been interesting, but it was also very surprising to me, even among the teams that, you know, the Mets have habitually been crazy abusers of this. Teams that, when the trade deadline passes, like to get statements out where they're like, we tried, you know, like the Danny Ainge maneuver. I was surprised that they even bothered to put that out there. I don't imagine it was a lie. It's just sort of, it's confusing to see that range of response where you see what they actually did, which was nothing, and then to see what they almost did, which was presumably trade two of their top five prospects for a year and a half of Justin Verlander. Like, that is those don't fit together to me. Like, it's a very wide variance in terms of an understanding of where the team is. But I was reading about, you know, Bloom talking about how they're an underdog and all this other sort of stuff, and I guess it's just the thing that I sort of feel a sympathy pang for my Red Sox fan friends, is that I don't get a sense of, like, where they are in whatever this process is, like how far along they are, or what they're trying to do, and not trading the one-year rental guys for a scratch-and-win ticket. I guess it's better than having the team get worse down the stretch, but it doesn't make it any clearer where you are in however long and however, you know, serious a rebuilding project this is going to be.
Well, that's the frustrating thing, is there doesn't really seem to be much in the way of a plan other than, hey, don't worry, Chris Sale will be back soon, and nobody's more dependable down the stretch than him.
Right. I mean, that's the part of it. I, you know, of all the sort of post-deadline cliches, the one that I think I'm the most sort of scarred by as a Mets fan was the player whose rehab you mismanaged as an organization returning in August, and then the GM coming out and saying, well, it's a lot like getting Noah Syndergaard back at the trade deadline. You know, it's like acquiring a star at the deadline. And I know the Sox are kind of trying for that with Trevor Story and Sale right now, but I think it'll be a little late by the time they get there. And I also think that, like, I don't know who the Red Sox fans are that are on the, you know, oh, goody, Trevor Story, like, mindset. Is that can't be a common perspective at this point.
No, I don't think so. We're talking with David Roth here on Downtown. How was your most recent trip to Maine?
Really good. This was more of a, like, task-oriented thing. We were helping my father-in-law stock the antique mall setup that he's got. He sells out of a antique mall in Mechanic Falls, which is near Sebago Lake and stuff. And so he's just one guy, and my wife and I very much want to help him move some of the clutter, much of which we've been looking at for 3 years every time we go visit him, into the mall and then back out into the world. So we got to move a couple carfuls this time around, which was exciting. And there's a new, he does his sort of, he's retired, he's a retired fireman, and he sells antiques, you know, and mostly buys, sometimes sells. So we got to do the sort of the tour of the local, you know, Salvation Army here. There's a new junk store there, which I think my wife, if there aren't good books, she'll just be bored and we'll go sit in the car. But a lot of those places have a kind of a crappy baseball card component to them. So, like, if there's a junk store that has a few boxes of common cards from the 1970s in it, as the one that we visited most frequently did, I was perfectly fine. Just kind of, I wasn't going to buy anything because I didn't want to have to explain why I was bringing, you know, a visibly stained George Foster 1975 Topps card back into our home. But it's, I enjoyed looking at it. So that part was fun.
Well, yes. And
was, you know.
Hold on, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I think we had a good time. It was the challenging part was that it was 90 degrees the entire time we were up there.
Right.
And it's just not, I mean, you obviously have had to deal with this too up there, but the house she grew up in, like, there's not air conditioning. There's not room for air conditioning. Like, it's in a part of the world that never had any need for it. And so we were struggling. I mean, it was, we had a fan in the window and we were able to sleep all right, but that's not a part of the country that should be 90 degrees every day, in my opinion.
No, that's absolutely right. I'm wondering if those baseball card finds, though, have they fueled your success in, well, my new obsession too, Immaculate Grid?
Oh, yeah. I'm completely gone off that. There's like, at this point, I'm not even embarrassed about what my habit looks like, so I'm willing to admit that I do it several times a day in incognito windows with different names. It's great. I like it. It also is a little embarrassing that something that really feels like something that could have been just burped up by my unconscious, like just some bad, undigested idea, is now like a real thing that I can talk to normal people about. But yeah, it's been fun. Do you have, I've been doing it enough at this point that I'm able to, today's grid, for instance, I was able to use a guy named Miguel DeLaunay.
Nice.
Cleveland. So that guy's whole career happened before I was born. I know him exclusively from a guy that was on league leaders cards as, like, he won the batting title 1 year. He stole 50 bases. But he, you know, there haven't been that many obscure 300 hitters in Cleveland Indians Guardians history. So, like, I feel much more sort of, like, I've thought of Miguel DeLaunay more since Immaculate Grid came online than I did in the previous 44 years of my life.
What's interesting is, and I don't know what fuels this, but I never think of anybody recent. And so my mind is flashing back to, you know, 60s, 70s, and frankly, the old baseball cards I had, or like with that one today, the Cleveland guy who hit 300, my pick was Bobby Avila, like back in 1954 or something.
Yeah. Well, so this is the thing with the game, and I don't know if you, I guess, whatever, we can talk about this. We're friends. I'm sure the people listening know.
You go to baseballreference.com.
So in this case, I like to try to get the lowest possible score that I can in terms of rarity. You know, so I want to pick players that nobody else is thinking about.
Me too.
Now, right, good. All right, that makes me feel seen. It makes me feel better. still a little embarrassing to be talking about this on the radio, but just keep going. So what I've noticed is that for when people are filling it out, people that are playing now or basically anything that happened before the year 2000 is not really widely remembered in the game. And anything that happened before 1960 might as well be made up. And so if you want to get low scores, like players from the 70s and 80s really deliver those in a way that, like, you know, I don't know enough about turn of the century baseball to, you know, just sort of be like, oh yeah, that was like Hogwash McCotton did that with the Philadelphia Athletics. And then, you know, like, and then that works, but I don't know that person. I should say I just made that up. So, but with one of the Red Sox guys that I use a lot is someone named Reggie Jefferson.
Yes.
Today. And I don't know, I don't remember Reggie Jefferson as a player hardly at all. I had a bunch of his rookie cards when he was with the Reds. And I remember he was with the Red Sox, I think when they, the good 90s teams, not the World Series championship teams, I think. But I remember him very fondly. And so there's players where you remember every team they played for. And then, you know, there's guys that, as I've gone back through to sort of check my work after I fill out the grid, like, I realized today that I'd completely forgotten that Dave Burba existed. And that's fine. There's no reason for me to have known in the first place. But I had absolutely, it had slipped my mind. And then, you know, so now I'm reminded of all of these
things. Well, I'm glad.
Any, like, go-tos?
I'm glad
for
you.
Weird socks?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I go back. Like, I'm glad that approach is as strange as mine, because that's what I do. If I pick a guy and his percentage is more than 2%, I feel like I failed. Like, I went with the obvious choice. Yesterday, I think it was Red Sox 20-game winner, and I went, well, let's see. Do I go with Mel Parnell from 1949 or Bill Mombokel? Let's go with Mel Parnell. And it was like 0.08%. Yes, I'm a winner.
Hell yeah. That's really good. I had Jim Lomborg, I think, for that one, and I was pleased with myself because that's another guy that's like, it's before my time, but I had his baseball card. Anytime you can type in Bill Mombokel's name and be sure that you're right when you're doing it, that has to feel amazing.
Yeah, I tried Rennie Stennett for something today, and I was snubbed on that one. I was wrong. But you know what? I guessed a guy who had 7 hits in a game, and that's got to be worth something.
Yeah. The thing that's funny with these is realizing what types of players you remember, because there's players I remember watching. But then there's also, I've realized that, like, somewhere in my brain, I've sorted by memorability, if that's not really a word, but most or least memorable. It's like extra large relief pitchers, kind of like nervous looking mustachioed pinch hitter types. Like, those are the guys that are stuck in there. So I can completely forget about guys that had good long runs, you know, at the middle to the top of rotations, even, you know, during the last 15 years. And yet, like, Mike Fetters, like, I think I do remember every team that Mike Fetters played for. I don't remember why that is. I can tell you that it's because he used to make a silly face and he would turn to face home plate because he just kind of looked like he's just a chunky guy. But yeah, all the any of your jumbo fridge shaped relief pitching guys, it's great to have an opportunity to remember them. And
I always remember.
I wrote one post about it, so I can call it work.
Yeah, middle relievers, like today it was guys who played for the Giants and the Red Sox. And first of all, I wanted to block out the memory of Pablo Sandoval, but I immediately thought, oh, well, of course, Bob Bolan, because I got his baseball card in every other pack when I was a kid.
Yep. Do you have so this is the thing, too, with it, because I collected baseball cards very avidly as a kid, but also you're a little older than me, I think, but it was much harder to watch teams on TV. Like, there's players who I, you know, have baseball cards tracking a decade of their life, you know, and I kept all of them and I sorted them by team and I did all the things that little weenies did back then. But I don't think I ever actually saw them play.
Right.
And
right.
So there's people that I remember entirely as baseball cards. You know, I could tell you a lot about, like, Junior Ortiz, but I couldn't tell you what his batting stance looked like. I could tell you, like, and I could tell you the teams he played for, but I've never seen an action photo of him because those were too, like, that was too much trouble for Topps. So it was just a lot of pictures of him looking bearded and wistful in the dugout.
Yes, my childhood nerddom has paid off, but my recent practices are hurting me because I've been in a fantasy league for like 35 years, and it's American League only. So I know all those guys, but I know nothing about most national leaguers of the last 30 years, other than if they happen to play the Red Sox in the World Series, or maybe I caught them in an All-Star game.
Yeah, I've had similar stuff with that. I mean, that's the other big hole in mine was, I guess, like basically when I was in college to a few years after, I just wasn't assimilating new baseball information because I was like trying to kiss girls and like go to rock concerts and stuff. And then at some point I was like, no, I'd really rather get back to knowing about like Richard Hidalgo and Derek Bell. This is more my comfort zone. But there was that period where you realize, like, in your case, at least you can say, yeah, I've been in a league with my friends for 30 odd years. And that's why I have, you know, vivid opinions about like Paul Sorrento and Ben Broussard, but no recollection at all about half these National League All-Stars.
Wow. You know me. You know me too well, Mr. Roth. Well, big day here, I guess, in the history books, although isn't it interesting that we've reached a point in America where, oh, it's just another indictment for the front runner for the Republican nomination.
I was telling Kerry before we came out, I was like, was there something new? He's like, I don't know. I don't think so. I think it's just new developments in the thing, but you have to ask, because at this point, it's every 72 hours, there's the possibility of, you know, six new charges being unveiled in some new state for some, you know, none of it's exactly new offenses, but it's stuff that you sort of, if, you know, you've been following it, had given up maybe on him ever being held accountable for. It's really this last one I've read enough about to get the sense that this is the bigger one, you know, the biggest deal of these. And yet it's hard to sort of, because of the timetable, you know, on which this is all unfolding and because of the exceptional crappiness of the discourse that surrounds it. I mean, just a ton of bad faith and a ton of sort of misdirection and all of that. It's hard to know how seriously, well, not how seriously to take it, but like what it's going to amount to. I think it's good to look at it and realize that this is, you know, unprecedented and extremely bad behavior, but it's hard to, you know, bear all that in mind and then also, you know, think about what is likely to actually come of it, which at this point, it's, you know, if, you know, the one that Trump loves to talk about is, you know, having to spend 500 years in jail or whatever, which, you know, it's nice to think about and all that, kind of giving him the general Zod treatment. but I also don't think, you know, it's harder to believe that there's going to be any consequence at all just because, you know, there hasn't been to date. And so it's still, it's strange. I mean, I think I would feel like this even if I was not experiencing the 2020, 2021 feeling of being quarantined in my own home. But there's this sense somehow that we've like lapped ourselves and we're having a conversation about something that we've had a conversation about before. And one way or another, I would love to get off of it and get on to whatever's next. I just feel like Trump fundamentally, you know, beyond as a candidate or as a politician or the leader of a movement or whatever, is just, he's a waste of time, and I can't wait to stop thinking about him.
But what do you think is the way out of that? I mean, because unless he's in jail and they cut off communication, he's going to continue to be part of the long-term conversation. And there is a tiresomeness to it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's kind of, I mean, it's the end of the Republican Party in a lot of ways, and yet at the same time, it's like, I mean, nothing really ends, I guess. It does feel like a death spiral. I mean, I think there is definitely a chance that he runs for president from jail, you know? Like, it's been done. I mean, it seemed cooler when Eugene Debs did it, but it's not the sort of thing that, you know, hasn't happened before. It still has this feeling, though, of, I mean, I just can't, all of it, I keep reading about, you know, there's some statements in this one, you know, I guess it's still all, you know, co-conspirator number five, we don't know who everybody is, and I don't remember the names of all the, you know, the sort of acting attorney general types that he was cycling through during the the last days. I believe it was Jeffrey Clark,
right,
that had made some sort of point about, you know, if they're if we declare victory and don't leave, then there'll be protests in every city. And he said something about, well, that's what the Insurrection Act is for. Like, basically the idea being then that you would send the military out to go mow down protesters and protect. And that, to me, is like, you know, you should, if you're talking seriously about that, like, you need to be held accountable for it, because that's, like, one thing you really can't do.
Yeah, that seems,
if you want to be a democracy, you can't talk about stuff like that.
Bad. And yet, with all that, I must say I'm still amused by watching Ron DeSantis flail about in his awkward, I really don't like talking to people kind of way.
He's amazing. I mean, as somebody who can be anxious, you know, in certain social situations, I can't say that I've ever, like, this is about as bad as I can watch someone be at that and not feel even a single pang of sympathy for them. He just stinks. I mean, this is the, you don't want to, like, be too reductive about it. Like, obviously there's, you know, retail politics is different from one place to another. Running for governor is different than running for president. All of this is true. Also, brother, he sucks. Like, he just can't do it. He doesn't, like, as a retail politician, he does not have the stuff. And so watching him be, I mean, this is still, you know, one of the last vestiges of, like, the old ways of democracy. Like, you know, Trump didn't have to go to a state fair and eat, you know, something on a stick. That was not, no one expected him to do that, because he was, you know, the man who owned a plane. DeSantis has to go do all of that stuff, and he's just not cut out for it. And so what you get is this kind of, like, weepy, whiny, unpleasant guy chastising children for having sugary desserts. And, like, I mean, it does, for all of the things that are sort of, like, implied in Kerry's question about Trump, you know, running again and stuff, if the answer to that question is what kind of person could lose to a guy who's been indicted three times in 6 months, the answer is the guy who talks like he's holding his nose and is constantly telling kids that they shouldn't be eating sugary snacks. That is, like, one of the very few people that could do it.
There you go. By the way, speaking of Kerry, now, he is leaving us. He's moving officially to New Orleans in mid-September. And I've said to him, look, who do we want to get on the show that we want to make sure we have on before you leave? And the top of the list, well, it was, you know, people we can't get, but people we're likely to get, it was you, David Roth. He said, we got to try to get David on one more time before I go.
I'm honored to be high among the gettable ones. And also, you know, I'm sorry that you'll be leaving the show, but if you could pick a place to move, New Orleans is pretty cool, man. I have one of my friends moved down there during the pandemic, and she's never been happier.
We've been planning it for a long time. We actually bought the house down there in 2018. So this has been in the works for a while, and I'll continue making occasional appearances on the show, but unfortunately won't be able to do the daily thing anymore.
Yeah, you're not going to be trying to do a bi-coastal thing where you're in Maine some of the time and Louisiana some of the time?
A little bit, but limited. Yeah, like, you know, 3-4 weeks a year, because my wife's family is still up here, so we'll be up here occasionally.
Yeah, more or less the same cadence as me then. But it's good, though. That's something to look forward to. And whatever, New Orleans is great. I mean, it really is like the American city to me. I've only been there for, like, I don't know, 3-4 days, and it was around my friend Mike's wedding. I had a sandwich there that I still think about probably once a week.
That really sounds about right. Town.
I think you're going to enjoy it a lot.
That's fantastic. I love it. Hey, David, always good to talk with you. Hope you're feeling better soon and back out there circulating with, well, the people you choose to be around.
Thank you, guys. I appreciate it. And thank you for having me. And Kerry, good luck, man. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
David Roth, Defector, the Distraction Podcast.